Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush, speaking today after meeting with State Department officials on the topic of Iraq, said he had a better sense of what's going on the ground there. He also said he's listening to advice from many sources. In Iraq, gunmen pulled off a bank heist today, reportedly taking $1 million. There are reports of an effort by Iraqi lawmakers to oust Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Three explosions struck Baghdad within a span of 2 hours today. And last night, a bomb in the capital killed three American soldiers, raising the number of American servicemen killed this month, which is young yet, to 46. Borzu Daragahi is Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, let's start with that bank robbery. How common is that?
You know, it's become increasingly common. There is some speculation that these are bank robbers who are using this tool to finance the insurgency. 20 men disguised as police driving SUVs that are similar to those issued to police stopped a vehicle that was transporting the money to the central bank. They made off with the cash, as well as kidnapping four of the security guards who were supposedly protecting the vehicle. Possibly they were complicit, the security guards.
How about this effort to oust al-Maliki? Word that Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, the senior Shiite politician who met with President Bush in Washington last week, may be leading that effort, spurred on by both the Iraq Study Group report and the memo that was leaked from a State Department official saying that the Bush administration didn't have faith in Maliki. Is there, is there a sense that there may be some sort of a coup?
Well, I think that we've been talking to politicians about that all day, and they said it's not going to be anything as direct as that. If it happens, it's going to be a legal maneuver that's going to be through loopholes and clauses in the Constitution. It should be said that Abdulaziz Hakim has never been a strong backer of Maliki. He's had his own horse in that race, Adel Mahdi. And so, Maliki's never really counted on his strong support, so it's no big surprise that he would be doing this. However, to talk about a coup d'etat in this situation, there's no state to overthrow, really. There's no functioning government. I don't know what difference it would make. It's not like you take something over. There's nothing there to take over because the government doesn't really have a lot of power.
You're saying no d'etat involved in it. There's no
exactly.
State. Yeah. Well, but it could lead to, incredible chaos because I'm thinking of Muqtada al-Sadr, who has the largest militia in Iraq, who is said to be a strong backer of Prime Minister Maliki, and yet has been boycotting his government because Maliki met with President Bush. There's been a sharp split between the two. What happens if Sadr and Maliki part ways? Is Maliki then really doomed if he doesn't have Sadr support?
Well, I think Sadr is a crafty person, and his followers have their price, and so they can be plied away from Maliki. The whole boycotting the parliament because Maliki was visiting Washington, it was more of a gesture than a concrete act. But it is true that there is a lot of dissatisfaction on the part of everyone here with Maliki at the steering wheel. But the problem is that it may be that the driver is not the problem, that the car is totally faulty.
Borzu, we read reports over the weekend that the government, even though it seems to be somewhat fractured, is announcing that it will come up with some sort of plan to divvy up Iraq's oil revenues, and as soon as this week. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're getting reports that that's already falling apart. In Iraq, politicians will say anything if you goad them to, and they all have all sorts of plans and proposals, but really, even when they're approved, there's a little problem with execution here. So we don't place much credence in the plans and maneuvers and laws that are enacted by the Iraqi lawmakers at this time.
We're going to be taking a look later in the week, Borzu, at the looming problem of refugees streaming out of Iraq and many of them wanting to come to the U.S. But how are you feeling that issue there? Are you seeing people streaming out? I understand you were telling our producer before we got on the line that there was no one on the streets today.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I was recently at the airport in Amman, and I saw one of my former translators here, and it was really sad. We just kind of ran into each other. He was on his way out of the country. He was with his wife, his daughter. He was with his brother, and they were all heading out of Iraq to find asylum in Europe somewhere. And then today, driving around, I was just amazed at the just how little traffic there was for a Monday, which is usually a very busy day in Baghdad. And I remember just totally cursing the traffic that I used to encounter. And we just got through the city in just nothing. There was no traffic whatsoever. And I asked my driver, who doesn't speak a lot of English, you know, why is there no traffic? What happened? And he was just sort of, he was like Sunni, Shiite, boom, boom, bang, bang. Essentially telling me that the reason why there's no traffic is because there's a war going on.
Borzu Daragahi, Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, as always, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, to politics now in the U.S., where the 2008 race for the White House is unfolding in the shadow of the war in Iraq, Republicans scanning the horizon for their next presidential contender. And the early buzz on the Democratic side is generated by two politicians who haven't even formally declared their candidacy but are both in the news today. New York Senator Hillary Clinton said today she won't make a decision about running till after the first of the year, but she also said she's talking to people in New York and across the country about a possible campaign. And that's the first time the former First Lady has publicly confirmed what her aides and fellow Democrats have been saying for a while. Meanwhile, in Illinois, Senator Barack Obama, basking in the glow of his first visit to New Hampshire, the state that holds the first presidential primary, he sparked a frenzy yesterday when he signed copies of his book in Portsmouth and spoke at a packed rally in Manchester. Well, the race for the White House has taken on new meaning in the wake of the Iraq Study Group report, and we want to spend some time today on how that race is shaping up. Joining us, Jonathan Allen, reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Jonathan, welcome as always.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by New Hampshire Public Radio political reporter Josh Rogers. Josh, you covered that event last night in Manchester, right?
I did.
Well, tell us, first of all, about that. We hear more than 1,000 people there. A lot of media outlets were turned down. That's so unheard of so early in this rally. What was it like?
Well, it was quite a spectacle. At the rally in Manchester, there were 1,600-plus tickets sold. Allegedly, another 1,000 people wanted to get in. There were 150 members of the credentialed press, including people from as far away as Japan and Australia. Mm-hmm. It was pretty weird. It was almost as if the atmosphere was like the home stretch of a primary. Mm-hmm. Fox News was even doing a live stand-up during his speech. I mean, it really was not what you'd expect for a candidate who's not yet declared making his first visit to New Hampshire.
Right. He acknowledged the excitement he seems to be generating. Let's listen to a little of what he had to say.
You know, I actually think that the reason that I'm getting so much attention right now has less to do with me and more to do with you. I think to some degree I've become a shorthand or a symbol or a stand-in for now of a spirit that the last election in New Hampshire represented. And it's a spirit that says we are looking for something different. We want something new.
Barack Obama speaking last night in Manchester, New Hampshire. Josh Rogers, who was covering it, you know, people are wondering, well, you know, maybe it is more of a symbolic, not even candidacy, non-candidacy. Did he say anything about some of the more important issues about Iraq, the Iraq Study Group report? Was he asked about it, and what did he say?
He didn't say very much about Iraq at all. He did talk about the need for what he called the tough and smart foreign policy and said that that he had no doubts that all Americans would be patriotic enough to defend their country if it were under threat, but that the United States shouldn't be in conflicts, which he said, I think he called them, ideological experiments. But he didn't offer any direct comments on the study group report, nor did he do anything but sort of insinuate that he would favor a redeployment during the speech. He said that, if Americans come together, then problems ranging from Iraq to energy independence to some sort of national health care and better schools and better pay for teachers would be attainable. But he didn't offer anything specific on any topic, really.
Well, Jonathan Allen, want to bring you back in again from Congressional Quarterly. Given that, What is the national perspective on Barack Obama's potential candidacy right now?
Well, I think it's still unproven. I think the point that was just made is an excellent one. There's not a whole lot of specificity on issues from him. We don't really know what Barack Obama represents. So he may see himself as a symbol at this point, but I don't know that anybody knows what he's a symbol of yet. And so I think that he hasn't really given us a lot in the Senate yet. I've been watching him for the last couple of years. He hasn't really been the leader on any issues except for earmark reform, which kind of fell apart. Lobbying reform that had sort of fallen apart in the Senate this year, and we're still waiting to see what it is exactly he symbolizes and what it is exactly he believes. And there's still some question as to whether he can translate a big victory in Illinois, which is a pretty Democratic state, over a very weak opponent, into the kind of national campaign that he would need to run to win both a Democratic primary, presumably against Hillary Clinton, and then a general election.
Well, Josh Rogers, before we let you go, though, it'd be hard to dismiss him or any Democratic candidate in New Hampshire this year after the midterm elections when the Republicans were overthrown.
Well, that's certainly the case. I mean, people are looking back to the 19th century to look for a comparable gains by Democrats. And, you know, that was Obama's putative purpose for being here, was to celebrate the large Democratic gains, which trickled down to the most local races in New Hampshire. And I do think that while, you know, everybody's looking for specificity, you know, New Hampshire people are leery of someone who would come in and propose anything much. I mean, this was his first visit, and so he's got plenty of time if he gets in the race. And, you know, a lot of the more operative types I was talking to seem to think that, you know, you need to be a good steward of your own momentum. And, you know, people are always, you know, even people who said that they would support Obama said, well, you know, what I'm really worried about is that, you know, he might, you know, peak too early. I mean, we are a long ways away,
right,
and there's
right.
still plenty about him we don't know.
Josh Rogers, political reporter for the New Hampshire Public Radio, giving us insight into what happened last night in Manchester. Josh, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Robin.
And we're staying with Jonathan Allen from Congressional Quarterly. Jonathan, Indiana Senator Evan Bayh was in Keene and Cornish, poor guy, yesterday, you know, someone in the shadow of Barack Obama. Senator Joe Biden heading there next week. Other candidates, former Senator John Edwards, Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, all either throwing their hats or about to, you know, take off their hat and throw it in the race. But you say, you know, you mentioned Senator Hillary Clinton, who spoke today for the first time, you know, confirming that she's considering. Does she automatically become the front runner?
Absolutely. She's the big fish in the pond right now, and certainly if she runs, I think that the challenge for any of the rest of them is to beat her. And frankly, I think the more candidates are in the race, the better it is for her. She's going to attempt to quickly consolidate fundraising and the money in the race, and to try to get the people who are the top campaign operatives to work for her. And I think that if you're a Democratic operative or a Democratic donor, you've got to think long and hard about whether you want to join someone else's campaign, because that may hurt your political career if you work against Hillary Clinton and she ends up becoming a nominee. That said, she has not announced yet, and if she doesn't run, it's certainly a wide open field. And it is possible that the Democrats who don't like Hillary Clinton or think that she wouldn't be able to win a general election might consolidate behind someone else. But I think for right now, she'd have to be seen as the front runner by a large margin.
That's Jonathan Allen, reporter for Congressional Quarterly. John, we're going to take a quick break. I want you to stay right there.
I'll be here.
We're going to be joined also by Lee Bandy from down in South Carolina. Talk about the Republicans, Mitt Romney, John McCain. And is there a split in the Bush family fundraising machine between the two? Much more when we come back. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's early yet, but we are talking presidential politics with Jonathan Allen, reporter for the Congressional Quarterly, and Lee Bandy, the political columnist for the state newspaper in South Carolina. He joins us as well. Lee Bandy, welcome to you.
And thank you, and it's always good to be with you.
And we want to start taking a look at the Republican side, and I want you to both comment on some reading we've been doing in the Los Angeles Times today. Peter Walston is writing about a competition within the Republican Party over who will inherit the Bush family fundraising and get-out-the-vote machine. And in his story, Walston calls it one of the most valuable assets in modern politics. He writes the machine is split now, that Jeb Bush supporters are putting their money on Mitt Romney, Massachusetts governor. George Bush's people are going with John McCain. First of all, Jonathan Allen, are you seeing that split in the Republican Party?
Well, I think it's still a little early to tell how everyone's going to go. I mean, I certainly wouldn't quarrel with Peter's reporting. He's a former colleague of mine, I'm proud to say, and an excellent reporter. I think we're going to have to see how this breaks down. I think everyone's trying to figure out who, not only who is the best person to support, but also who's the most likely to win. People like to be influential, and the best way to do that is to pick a winner and get behind them. And I think that Romney and McCain are emerging as sort of the top guys right now. I imagine there's still a fair amount of uncommitted money out there and uncommitted support, and we'll see this shake out. But certainly a split in the sort of pioneer and ranger classes of Bush donors is a really important thing to watch, because as Walson points out, this was the, you know, a massive force in politics in favor of George Bush for a long time, and if they're split, they don't represent quite that force.
Well, here's how some pundits have been reading the tea leaves, that Jeb Bush's, again, governor of Florida, his longtime advisor Sally Bradshaw is now working for Mitt Romney, signaling that Jeb Bush is, you know, throwing his hat in that ring and maybe hoping to join Romney on the ticket as VP 2008.
Well, I guess it's a possibility. Obviously, Bush has said he doesn't want to run for president himself. He'd certainly make an attractive running mate candidate, and I think that if Mitt Romney's running for president from a state like Massachusetts, he probably needs to find somebody from the South, somebody that conservatives can really believe in. I think you'd have a ticket there that looks like it has strong executive experience and one that the GOP establishment would place a lot of trust in. I think it's very early for Mitt Romney to be picking a running mate, though, at this point. That might be counting his chickens before they hatch.
Well, and you write about trying to appeal to the religious conservatives. Jeb Bush is, as some have said, adored by religious conservatives for his role in the Terri Schiavo Right to Die case and in other stories. But Lee Bandy, down there in, down from where we are, in Columbia, South Carolina, Mitt Romney has been going to your state to do what?
Well, Mitt Romney has probably been here longer than any other candidate. He's been down here quietly signing up staff and supporters, and of course he landed a big one the other day in hiring Warren Tompkins. Mm-hmm. Warren Tompkins was George Bush's campaign manager here in 2000 when we had that real knockdown drag-out battle.
Yeah, with John McCain.
Right.
Yeah. Well, is he walking a tricky tightrope there, though? Because we understand he's been appealing to conservative Christians at several luncheon engagements, while also trying in other parts of the country to communicate that his own religion, Mormonism, is not going to be a factor.
Well, his faith has been an issue down here among some people, and he's tried to address it. It's hard to say whether it's going to have any impact on this race or not, but that is an issue worth watching.
Well, and Jonathan Allen, again, of the Congressional Quarterly, what about a letter that just surfaced? It's recent news. It's a letter that Mitt Romney wrote to the Log Cabin Club of Massachusetts. That's a gay Republican group. Back when he was running for the U.S. Senate against Ted Kennedy in 1994, a race he lost. In that letter, Romney promised he'd be a stronger advocate for gays and lesbians than Kennedy would, that they needed rights. And today, in Massachusetts, he leads the anti-same-sex marriage bandwagon, seems to have jumped bandwagons. Is that going to hurt him with conservatives?
I think it likely will. And Romney's got this issue not only with regard to gay marriage, but also with abortion. When he ran against Kennedy in 1994, he said he supported abortion rights. But at the time, his credibility on that issue was being challenged because there were a lot of people who believed that while he was saying he supported abortion rights, that in fact he was anti-abortion. Now you've got the other side of things where he's going to be a conservative on social issues, and people are going to say, well, now wait a second, in 1994 you said, hey, I'm for abortion rights and I'm for gay rights. And I think there's a big question as to where he stands on these issues, and certainly if he stands toward the middle where he was in 1994 on these issues, that's going to hurt him with social conservatives. I'm sure Lee can speak to this a little bit more, but the issue of his religion is certainly something that I think gives pause to evangelicals, particularly heavily Southern Baptists. Mm-hmm. Both Southern Baptists and Mormons are competing for people and expanding their religions, and they don't like each other's religions. And I think that that's something that he's also going to have to overcome. But like I said, I bet Lee can talk to that a little bit.
Well, actually, I'd like Lee instead to talk about John McCain, because I want to make sure we've touched on this. And as you said, Lee, you were there watching when it got pretty ugly between McCain and President Bush during the 2000 primary. Now, John McCain seems to be siding with a lot of the president's thoughts on the Iraq Study Group report. He took a hard line against the recommendation that there be more diplomacy with Iran. He's asking for more troops rather than less in Iraq. How is that, though, going to jive with what seems to be the public's real dissatisfaction with the war in Iraq?
I'm not sure that's going to play that well down here. I mean, I realize this is the South. This is South Carolina, one of the most patriotic, pro-military states in the country, but people down here are getting anxious. They want to get this war over with, and I'm not certain that McCain is taking a position down here that is going to be that well received.
Hmm. That's Lee Bandy, political columnist for the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. We also were speaking to Jonathan Allen, covers presidential politics for Congressional Quarterly, just helping us put our finger up in the wind and just see which way it's blowing. 2 years out, but as the race for presidents in 2008 heats up. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And as we said, this is all unfolding in the shadow of the war in Iraq. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the plight of Iraqi refugees. How many can the U.S. welcome, and how many might try to come? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As one of its final acts, the 109th Congress gave its okay last Friday to let energy companies begin oil and gas development in more than 8 million previously protected acres off the coast of Florida in the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, the White House has confirmed that President Bush is considering lifting a decades-old ban and allowing oil and gas drilling in Alaska's Bristol Bay. The administration says the move could generate nearly $8 billion worth of oil and gas and create as many as 12,000 jobs. Bristol Bay, a 33-million-acre tract of open ocean just north of where the Aleutian Islands meet the Alaskan mainland, was put off limits to oil drilling in the wake of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. Rick Steiner is a marine biologist at the University of Alaska in Anchorage. He joins us now. And Professor Steiner, you say Bristol Bay is one of the most productive ecosystems in the world. So first of all, why?
Well, it certainly is. It's really the heart of the Bering Sea ecosystem, which is clearly the most productive within U.S. jurisdiction and certainly one of the most productive in the world. There's more fish, crab, marine mammals, seabirds, primary and secondary productivity right within the southeastern Bering Sea than anywhere else in the United States, and it's one of the most productive marine ecosystems anywhere on the planet.
Why is that, by the way? I mean, what?
Well, for several reasons. One is because of the extraordinary turbulence of these enormous storm systems that come through there. There's a continental shelf which is extremely vast in the eastern Bering Sea, and so the nutrients that are produced near shore and through the oceanic system stay there, and it's amazingly productive for phytoplankton and zooplankton, and then everything that follows
right. That
comes downstream
right there.
So it's the heart of the Bering Sea ecosystem, to be sure.
And one of the things that comes down in that food chain is the North Pacific right whale, the poster animal, if you will, in Bristol Bay for endangered species. Tell us a little bit about this huge creature.
Well, there are many threatened and endangered species in the region, but you're right, the North Pacific right whale is certainly the poster child here. It's one of the great baleen whales. There were tens of thousands across the North Pacific historically, and it was actually the first heavily commercially exploited whales in the early 1800s. Now there's maybe 35. We know of 35 individuals left in the eastern North Pacific population. There may be as many as 50 or 60, but there's certainly less than 100. It's clearly the most critically endangered whale on the planet today. And this area in Bristol Bay, and sort of the outside of Bristol Bay, is their last remaining refuge. It was just designated critical habitat just this summer by the U.S. government for the North Pacific right whale. It's the last refuge for what remains of this once dominant whale in the Pacific, and it's here and only here that they'll either survive or perish for all time.
Well, besides the whales, you call this area the breadbasket for Bering Sea fish, for commercial fishing, particularly popular for, you know, dinner specials like salmon and pollock. I mean, things people really eat in a $500 million industry?
Yeah, it's, you know, this one particular area of the southeastern Bering Sea, you know, it's maybe 10 to 20,000 square miles. It's not, and given the magnitude of Alaska, that's not a lot. But this is really the heart of the Bering Sea ecosystem. Something like $500 million a year of fish catch comes from this place. About 400,000 tons, which is about 1 billion pounds of groundfish, mainly pollock, cod, and sole, come right out of this area. King crab, tanner crab, scallops, and then you've got the largest salmon run anywhere in the world that swims right through the North Aleutian Basin, right into the Bristol Bay river drainages, sometimes 50 or 60 million fish in one salmon run in a summer will come into the bay. Next year's run is projected to be about 35 to 40 million fish. That's a lot of salmon by world standards, and these salmon are extremely sensitive to pollutants. And so the juveniles would be swimming right out past the oil leases and right, the adults right back in through them. And, you know, so anything that puts that at risk, particularly an accidental large oil spill, should be avoided. We learned in Prince William Sound that salmon are extremely sensitive, particularly in their early life history, to pollutants. So it's a risk.
Do you think the industry has learned from Exxon Valdez? I mean, they might say, and for instance, Shell Oil is saying, we can get crude and natural gas out of Bristol Bay safely. You know, they're saying that, yes, there was this terrible accident, and they say they've put systems in place that will avoid things like that and other problems.
Well, you know, the Exxon Valdez was sort of a seminal wake-up call for the oil industry throughout the world, sort of like Chernobyl was to nuclear and Bhopal to chemical, et cetera. And here we are almost 18 years later, and most of the ecosystem injured by that spill has yet to recover. There's still oil in the beaches. The same thing would happen in the North Aleutian Basin in Bristol Bay should there be a catastrophic release of oil. The industry is fond of saying that they have a very good track record in OCS, Outer Continental Shelf leasing and development. But you look at some of the accidents, you know, the Santa Barbara blowout in 69 that sort of got everybody thinking about marine ecosystems, and then that was several million gallons. And then the largest accidental oil spill in history, the Ixtoc blowout, was in the Gulf of Mexico in 1979, and several hundred million gallons of oil came out of that. Then the Piper Alpha explosion in the North Sea in 1988, and 170 guys died in that, and lots of oil was spilled. And so the take-home lesson is, while these may be low-probability events, they have such high consequence that we have to think about that in our risk analyses and then make a decision, make a policy decision. Is the potential benefit to the nation and to the local communities worth the potential risk?
Just want to touch on something that we found interesting. President Bush is, of course, the one who's considering overturning this executive order, the ban on drilling in the area, and it was put in place by his father, George H.W. Bush, after Exxon Valdez.
That's no small irony, isn't it? And, you know, his dad, George Sr., put that moratorium in place to protect Bristol Bay for very good reason. I mean, there was a lot of political heat on the administration then in 1989 because of the extraordinary damage caused by the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And, you know, on Exxon Valdez, beforehand, we were promised all sorts of things, that there would be a state-of-the-art spill response system, that there would be a great vessel traffic system, that we'd have only double-hulled tankers. And as soon as they got the bill passed to put the pipeline across Alaska, all those promises went away. And so nobody really thought that, or the industry and the government really never thought that there is a real probability of a catastrophic oil spill like this. Well, they were wrong. And Exxon Valdez showed that very, very clearly. So Father George administration put the moratorium in place in Bristol Bay basically to cover the, there's political backside, saying that, you know, that this is just too risky. it was put in place for a very good reason then. Those reasons are still valid today, and the bottom line is, you know, what's more important here? A few months of national hydrocarbon demand, which is all that the Bristol Bay Reservoir would provide, or this continued extraordinarily productive, sustainable marine ecosystem out of which something like $500 million worth of fishery catch just from this one area comes every single year.
Rick Steiner, professor of marine biology at the University of Alaska in Anchorage. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been a delight.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, after spending the bulk of their adult lives in the frigid waters of the Pacific Northwest, sockeye salmon make their way back to their birthplaces upriver to spawn another generation. In British Columbia, along the Adams River, this happens just once every 4 years, and as you can imagine, it's quite a tourist attraction. Producer John Ryan was there at this Falls Salmon Run, and he sent us this audio postcard.
Oh, it's just neat. It's a life cycle, you know? That's...
Whoa, look at that guy. Oh, he's jumping.
It's just amazing to watch. To think that they came up 500 miles from the coast, you know, to come and spawn here, and then in the spring the eggs will turn into fish, and away they go and do it all over again. 4 years later, they're back from Japan or wherever they are, and they'll do it again. So it's amazing.
And does the smell bother you guys at all?
At first, it's a little bit off, but you can get used to it, I guess. Grows on you like a wart, maybe.
Well, we come here to see what life is like in the water with fish, you know. It's really fascinating, I think. It's really fascinating to see how the female will get in the sand and wiggle her body and make a spot for the eggs, and then the male follows right in behind and sprays, and that's it. Then they're off to die after that. They've done their job and their duty.
It's amazing how many there are like that. So you just, I'm seeing a lot of red fish with green heads. The male fish has that snout that sort of goes up, and the female ones are straight, like this one right here. That one there, look at that one. It's just about breathing its last few breaths, eh? It's sort of sad, but we know it's got to happen. But yet, you know, they're laying eggs, and it's amazing how it goes.
Mommy, the fish over there, blink. Whoa!
Oh, it's really amazing. Yeah, everybody should experience it once in their life, at least.
Look at all the tails over there. Then after a while, they'll all go down, eh? And then there'll be dozens of tails out like that, the way it is there again. Then they'll all go under. And look at the fish across the river. There's a lot. Look at that across there. It's just thick.
They were saying that there's over 4 million of these sockeye were supposed to go upstream this year. So that means 4 years from now, they'll have a large return of sockeye as well, every 4 years late.
See how low the river is? With hardly any snow these days, our waters are going down, down, down. It's a wonder they even get this far.
Go, salmon, go!
Go, salmon, go!
Go, salmon, go! Salmon, go!
You can see all the tails sticking out of the water right there.
Seagulls love it.
Oh, there goes another one.
Yeah. Seagull food, eh? And at the end, they become seagull food.
Go, salmon, go!
Our audio postcard on the Adams River Sockeye Salmon Run was produced by John Ryan. Well, we'll will close out our look today at the waters of the world in another part of the world. Officials from Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian Authority have agreed on a study to prevent the Dead Sea from dying. Water levels in the world's saltiest and lowest body of water have fallen about 3 feet a year for the past 2 decades, largely because of evaporation and the diversion of rivers to Syria and Israel. Geological experts warn it could disappear in 50 years. The $15 million study will be coordinated by the World Health Organization. It will look at the environmental consequences of diverting water from the nearby Red Sea. A canal linking the Red and Dead Seas is under consideration. It would link the two bodies of water, which are about 248 miles apart, and have a 1,320-foot difference in altitude. Keep an eye on that story for you. Meantime, stay with us. The newest Bach CD sets are next. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. For music lovers, the holiday season means box sets, compilations from your favorite artists. And for anyone interested in the educational value of gift giving, our music critic Tim Riley has chosen some CD boxes that connect some larger historical dots. And first, Tim, we must address what you have called box set backlash. And I'm wondering, you know, this is where everybody's downloading their music. If you love an artist, you're not going to wait for a box set. You've already got, you know, the albums you love. So really, do people buy the box sets?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, box sets do really well. In fact, that's a very significant part of the industry these days, even though the landscape has changed a lot in the last 10 years. And yet, the ironic thing that's happening with box sets is it's a really great time to be a music fan because a lot of stuff that wouldn't normally get published in this format is finding its way, and that means we're getting some more obscure performers further back in history. If you frame the artist correctly, and these box sets we're going to talk about are really nice frames for these artists, you can hear the music in a whole different way, and you can hear everything that comes after in a whole different way.
Well, take us through. You've got Fats Waller, I know.
Well, we'll start with Fats Waller, for example. He's one of the great stride pianists. Everyone knows him as the author and singer of Ain't Misbehavin'. And before World War II, he was a very popular, huge, how do you say, clownish giant, but his discography is just a mess, and without an encyclopedia, you're really at a loss. Mm-hmm. Well, a very important producer named Orrin Keepnews has put together a budget-priced 3-CD set that's called If You Gotta Ask, You Ain't Got It, that separates Waller's music into songwriting, instrumentals, and Tin Pan Alley standards, and gives a very revealing new portrait.
Like Jack Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses are worth waiting for. Leave me.
And what more does it add that maybe you didn't know?
Well, what I didn't know about Fats Waller was what a consummate pianist he was. He's right up there with Oscar Peterson and Teddy Wilson and even Art Tatum, if you ask me. A lot of this music goes down real easy. It's pure entertainment, but he's an extraordinary stride player, which means that left hand is constantly doing amazing things. And his chuckling persona tends to upstage his own facility.
Carolina Shout from the new Fats Waller box set. And by the way, we're going to have a link to all of this at our website, here-now.org, so you can find out more. And we want to hop now from R&B to country. Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys.
This is a 4-CD set called Legends of Country Music, and it chooses recordings made between 1932 and 1974, the year before he died. Wills is best known for a song called Rose of San Antone. But like Fats Waller, the more you listen, the tougher he is to pigeonhole.
That San Antonio Rose, yeah.
And what does Wills do? I mean, you know, he's a player, but what else does he do?
Well, he's the consummate country and western songwriter, arranger, singer, band leader. I mean, he's like the Duke Ellington of country swing, really. Mm. He was also a terrific vocalist, and he doesn't really get enough credit for some of his great vocals. Here's how he adapts a blues number in 1940.
Corrine, Corrina, where'd you stay last night? Tell me, Corrina, where'd you stay last night? was shining bright. Don't let that happen no more, Corrine. Look out, Al. Yeah.
This is Corrina. Bob Dylan did a version of this.
It's thought of as a country blues song, really, and he adapts it to his country swing style. But that style of singing, that direct, sincere, personable vocal, influences everybody, from Merle Haggard to George Strait.
Okay, so we got Bob Wills, Legends of Country Music, a 4-CD set. We'll look for that, too. All right, now to the blues, one of the big packages this year from the Chicago great Buddy Guy, who's still playing.
Yep, still out there with a big career. Now, you know, the story with Buddy Guy is that, you know, he got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Eric Clapton inducted him, even though a lot of his best work was done before he left Chess Records in 1969. He was a session player at the Chess Studios, and he played for Willie Dixon sessions and Muddy Waters sessions. So he really had a sort of like a tutorial with like the great blues people of all time. The early work that's captured here, especially on the first CD of this set, is really amazing. He's throwing fire, and he developed a voice that leapt straight out of his twang bar. But here he is singing an early Ike Turner number. This is from 1958.
Oh, yes, when you start to get lonesome, babe, I want you to fall on your knees and say a prayer to.
That is the kind of bobbled lightning that British blues bands were chasing all the way through, you know, up through Led Zeppelin. I mean, put that guy in a fright wig and he's Robert Plant, right? I mean, who does he influence more, Jimmy Page or Robert Plant? He's got both the guitar and the voice thing going at the same time.
All right, a box set from Buddy Guy. Do you recommend it for everyone or just for people who are already fans?
Well, of all the box sets we're talking about today, this is probably the one that I'll play mostly the first disc. So this is a qualified recommendation.
Because it's the oldest stuff and you want to learn about it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Finally, moving up in our chronological survey, there is a new Graham Parsons set. There might be people who say Graham Parsons is sadly deceased. He's left us. How is it that we keep getting more Graham Parsons?
Yeah, well, he's, you know, one of the, what the critics say, well, he's one of those dead guys who keeps putting out new records. If he didn't write such important material, his first two solo records from the early 70s are so important for so many different reasons. I mean, he really does map out a whole career for the Eagles, for example, blending country and rock at a time when country really was not thought of as, like, in hip in any way, shape, or form. And Graham Parsons just puts that over so beautifully. He discovers Emmylou Harris, and if he had only done that, he would have been remembered as discovering, you know, something great. But these duets that they sing on these two solo albums are really up there with Everly Brothers and Lubin Brothers, and they're really, really important. This package, this new Graham Parsons package, has a third CD that's all outtakes and leftovers, and so there's actually new material that we're getting here, and I wanted to play a new song that we're getting on this third CD called Brand New Heartache.
Why do you try to make me feel the way you do? Tonight we had a date, and you're 3 hours late. I feel a brand new heartache coming on.
A brand new song from Graham Parsons, that's nothing to snort at. And even the outtakes here are really special.
Well, there you have it, the box CD sets for this holiday from rock and pop critic Tim Riley. And we thought we were just listening to some good music. But no, Tim, you must be the bus driver because you were taking us to school.
That's right.
On some history there.
Right. Well, you weren't looking. I was trying to arrange some box sets that would map a larger stylistic diagram. And so what you get with Fats Waller and Bob Wills and Buddy Guy and Graham Parsons really is a working definition of where rock and roll comes from. It's the melding of all these different styles that gives us what, you know, our popular music has been for the past 50 years or so.
And Tim Riley, there's a good chance that any of these box sets will not be used as, you know, coasters holiday season. They'll be listened to.
Yeah.
Tim, thanks.
Thank you.
And you can find out more about all of the box sets at our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
All that meat and no potatoes,
just ain't right, like green tomatoes. Yeah, I'm waiting, palpitating, with all that meat and no potatoes. All that meat and no potatoes. All that food to the alligators, yeah. Hold me steady, I am ready.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.